a big part of mitigating any lasting impact is to communicate so positively in the good times so that you are ready for the bad times when they come.
Welcome to Communicating Purpose. I'm John Higginson, founder of purpose-led communications agency Higginson Strategy, and I believe that the best way to get a message across clearly is by talking about something you honestly and passionately believe in. By doing so, you bring people with you. Your passion becomes theirs, and I call this the power of purpose. Today, I'm joined by Nicola Green, the Chief Communications and Corporate Affairs Officer at Virgin Media O2. Nicola has a depth of experience in the world of corporate communications, having worked at the O2 in a variety of leadership roles since 2003. She directed the repositioning project of the Millennium Dome, if you remember it being called that, to the O2, and introduced the iPhone to the UK back in 2007. Right, you're to blame, Nicola. Nicola is a board member of Internet Matters, a non-profit specialising in children's online safety. She also has a keen interest in the alleviation of data poverty through the provision of free data and volunteers for women in PR, an organisation dedicated to increasing diversity in communications leadership positions. Nicola, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show with us today. Can you just tell us a bit more about your journey to where you are today?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been in this industry for over 25 years. When you add that up, it's a very long time. And I started out actually being quite clear that I wanted to get into communications. I read an article in Jackie magazine about a career in PR. And from that very moment, I knew that this is what I wanted to do. I know it sounds very, very weird, but that was the case. I then, after my A-levels, which I didn't actually do very well at, not as well as I was predicted, I decided to take a year out in industry with Nottingham University and ended up being in the corporate communications department for PowerGen, where I spent a year and did one day a month out at Nottingham University. And from then decided absolutely that comms was exactly what I wanted to go into. And that managed to get us secure a place at Leeds University, doing PR and marketing. I then did manage to land a role as a graduate at Burson Marsteller. So spent time working on lots of Unilever products and also spent some time in New York, which was fantastic grounding, I think, to go into the industry. And from there, have worked on lots of different clients from Dr. Pepper. And then I managed to go into Orange, left from agency life, went into Orange. And that is where I have to say I learned so much about launching a brand, owning it, how you kind of drive kind of favorability up. And from then came over to O2. And the rest, as they say, is kind of history. I'm now at Virgin Media O2. Like you said, I've worked in lots of different roles at O2 and now at Virgin Media O2. I lead a team of 65 within an organization of 15,000. I oversee everything from external comms, PR, internal comms, social media, content and channels, public affairs, events, and ESG, of which the ESG and the purpose element is very, very important to me. So I have a huge lot of responsibilities, including strategy, transformation, making sure we drive profit into the organisation, but reputation as well. So I'm also very, very passionate about campaigning to end the digital divide, which I hope we'll come on to in a little bit more detail a little bit later on. But that gives you an overview of being probably one of those strange kids that knew that I actually wanted to go into comms, which I think is half the problem young people face these days, is actually not knowing what they actually want to do or what's available to them. I took a lot of learnings about not doing as well as my A-levels to then prove a point to my brother, who was super bright, that I could actually be successful even if I didn't get the grades that I needed to at the beginning of that journey. So huge amounts of learnings during this time, but really kind of excited that I'm still in this industry. I still wake up every day feeling excited about what we can do and what we can achieve. So it's a good industry to come into.
Great. Well, those are some great lessons there in you know, making a decision early on, and And I made a decision early on that I wanted to be a journalist, and I didn't go through Jackie magazine, but there was, I don't know if you remember, that the Guardian used to have a very small version of The Guide, that it was called, and it was their...
Yes, I do.
Yeah, and it always used to have an advert at the back of it saying, do you want to become a writer? You know, we can turn you into a paid writer. And I think I was about 16 or 17, and I paid for that correspondence course to become a writer, and that was my first entry into that. But I think it's a good point. You know, we are in a world where you can choose so many things that it's quite hard to make decisions about anything. But actually, if you just make a decision early on, it can lead to success, and you don't necessarily need to have all the best grades. It's just about sticking at something, which in my view is more important. We will come on to data poverty, absolutely, and that's why I've got you onto the show. But first, I just wanted to ask you, because I'm fascinated by the renaming of things, because it's quite hard to do. We all call the great stadium that's in North Greenwich the O2 now, with all the concerts and entertainment things. But 25 years ago, and even longer than that before it was built, it was called the Millennium Dome. And then when the millennium came and went, it was called the Dome. But it's quite hard to do to get people to change a name, which is generally quite a good name, to a brand name. And I'd love to ask about how you managed to achieve that.
Yeah, and look, it was a fascinating and interesting time. And I think at the time when we were going through it, we didn't realise what a big impact it would have, certainly on the music scene, but certainly in the entertainment space. I think we were lucky in the fact that the Millennium Dome didn't have a good reputation. Everybody saw it as a bit of a waste of space, wasn't being utilised in the right way. So what we were offering helped us, because it meant that we could offer something really good and beneficial to the local communities, but also, like I say, to everybody who has experienced entertainment. I can tell you that I went into the boardroom 3 times to try and get that deal off the ground, and twice it was rejected, because the board members at that time did not see the benefit, or thought it was too high risk to take on such a space that had such a bad reputation. And when we did get the sign off, and we absolutely talked about the benefits that it could bring to our customer base, and we managed to get it through, there was a lot of campaigning work, a lot of talking to councillors, a lot of talking to MPs, a lot of talking with consumers. We did a proper campaign where we left absolutely no stone uncovered to really kind of talk about this new venue, and also the new name that we wanted it to be called. And I think because it was didn't have a good reputation, it was so much easier to do that. But we took journalists over to LA to see one of the stadiums that AEG had done over there, so they could see the benefits. We basically did a lot of work with press in talking to them about it, and talking to them about the new name that would be. And you know what? It's been really successful, but we never stop. You know, there was a time where every article, if it didn't mention the O2, myself or a member of my team would be calling up saying, please, can you use a proper name? We had good support from AEG, who were obviously the people who invested in it. So they were very supportive in actually calling it the O2. And a good piece of advice, I don't know if you know this, but every toilet is in the shape of a round circle to replicate our brand. So the detail that we had in, we were lucky because we could help create the O2, and we went to that level of detail to make sure that it would live and breathe the O2 brand. And we have been very successful in doing that. I think there was only one time in 2012 when the Olympics came when we weren't allowed to call it the O2. Yeah. And it went back to its original name. And I think it was interesting. Out of the coverage, if my memory serves me right, 80% of the coverage still branded it as the O2, even though legally we weren't meant to be doing that. And obviously that wasn't us pushing it. That was just because it became part of everyday life. So people were talking about it as the O2, that we managed to make it stick during a time when we weren't meant to be calling it that. Yeah. So, yeah, I think luckily for us, it will be here for a lot longer, and we will live and breathe and see how exciting as we kind of take it to the next level and continue to build on that. But
and can I ask how much that deal cost? Is that public information? Gosh. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it probably is, but I actually can't remember how much it cost right at the beginning.
And how long does it last for?
Well, because of the infrastructure that we've put in, we do 10-year deals. Right. And we're obviously in the second part of that 10-year, of a new 10-year deal. So there's it's going to stay around for a while, like I say. Yeah. But it's, it was a huge investment. And it was a risk definitely worth taking. But you can imagine going in and trying to say that you want to sponsor the Millennial Dome, that at first it didn't go down that well. No, we went into the board to have those conversations. But we got it over the line, which is great.
Well, that's certainly a bit of new information for me. So next time I'm going to a great gig. And I do think it is the best music venue in London now. And to have the best music venue in one of the world's best cities, if not the world's best city, is really something, and to have that name there. And the next time I go into the toilet, I will now have a look at the toilets and remember that point you've made there.
Yeah, there you go.
So going on to data poverty, it's something that you're really passionate about. And when we're talking about data, we're talking about mobile data here, so i.e. the ability to be able to look at the internet on your phone and to contact people on your phone. That's what we're talking about, that type of mobile data. So just tell us a bit about your work there.
Yeah, and you're right. It is something I'm personally very, very passionate about. And I think the reason why I'm passionate about it is because most of us take for granted the access to connectivity we have. And that we have the ability to how we navigate it and how we utilize it. But actually, and it came to light during COVID, millions of people in the UK still live without access to connectivity. And it is as many as 8.5 million who lack basic digital skills, and they needed to take advantage of the digital world. So this means that they are disadvantaged, I believe, because they can't get the employment that they want. They can't do the financial management. I mean, we all look at our phones and we manage our money through our mobile phones. We pay for things through our mobile phones. Schooling was a massive issue. And again, I saw it through COVID that there was definitely a divide of kids that could get online and still kind of learn during period of COVID and those that couldn't. And that to me was grossly unfair and something that really kind of brought to life to me this digital divide that we have within society. And I suppose Virgin Media O2 is absolutely committed to closing that digital divide and providing that much needed support and skills to those that absolutely need it most. And so much so, we've said that we want to aim to connect 1 million digitally excluded people across the UK and also equip 6 million people with digital skills and confidence to be able to utilise it in what I believe we live in, which is, well, I believe we live in a digital society today. And the one thing that we did, which I think is really standout, is we created a data bank. So this acts like a food bank, but it is actually for data. And we provide free mobile data, text and calls to those living in data poverty. And we work and founded the kind of national data bank. And this is now our leading, and we do it with our leading digital inclusion charity, which is the Good Things Foundation. So all of our O2 stores right across the country are hubs where people can go in and get their free SIM, regardless of whether they're an O2 customer or not. And we activate it with 25 gigabytes of credit, which can be topped up monthly. And I think it's made a massive difference. We did a big advertising campaign. And in that period, we managed to connect 4,000 people. Which doesn't sound a lot, but it's massive. And it's part of us going on this big journey of trying to get as many people as we can to connect it. And I think, you know, we know that people will and do need mobile connectivity in order to help them kind of live in this digital society that we face. So I'm really pleased about that. I know we've got an awful long way to go. We're working with lots of different partners at the moment to try and get our data out to as many people as we possibly can. But I do think in the places where we and the people and the feedback that we get from people who have got that connectivity through us it is really nice to see, and obviously makes me certainly feel good about giving back and giving something back to local communities and societies who are really facing some issues and struggles during certainly this cost of living crisis that we're all in today.
Great. And so you're not, so for people to get access to this, if anyone's listening to it and they feel they're in data poverty, they can just walk into a Virgin Media O2 store. They don't need to prove anything, do they? They can just go along and say, I can't afford to pay for a mobile phone SIM card. Can you give me one for free?
Absolutely. That's all they need to do. Don't have to prove absolutely anything. We've had to educate quite a lot of our retail staff because at one point they were turning away a delivery driver because they were like, no, you can't really need it because you've got a job, you're working for Deliveroo. And we were like, no, actually, people do have jobs, but they're having to pay for lots of different things. And connectivity, unfortunately, falls off if they're paying for a rent or, you know, fuel or energy in order to keep that place warm. So we've had to do a lot of educating with our people to make sure that we are open and get as many people as possible. We obviously have to make sure that they're not being used in the wrong way, which, you know, we do keep a monitor on that. But I'm pleased to say that that is in the minority, because a lot of it is going to the people who do just genuinely really, really need it and are grateful for having it.
Yeah. Well, I can see how that would be a hard one for staff, because I suppose staff are incentivized to sell plans. And if people are coming in and saying, in fact, I don't want to buy your plan, I want the free one, it's probably quite a hard one in their mind to say, okay, yeah, that's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
Great. Well, just tell me a bit about, I know that you've, as you said there, you've had a 25-year career in communications. Tell me about some of the crises that you've faced over the years and how you've approached those.
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, crisis communications is one of the areas that I actually do enjoy. I think as a comms person, I think being in a crisis tests you and makes you kind of realise the value that comms people can play. So I secretly do love a crisis, although I do not want to say that I want to have crisis, because that is not where any of us want to be. But look, any interruption to our service can be more than just annoyance, as many kind of critical infrastructures rely on Virgin Media O2 networks. So we do have to take our crisis response really, really seriously. And firstly, we're highly prepared. So we have a comprehensive risk matrix, traffic light systems, all of these buzzwords that you hear, but are very, very useful in kind of monitoring where we foresee potential crises to come. We have a crisis comms team that is simulated and regularly tested. And the teams are very, very clear about the personal roles and their responsibilities that all of us play in kind of getting either the network back up and running or anything else that we're doing. But our crisis handling internally, I think, is pretty seamless, and it's a seamless kind of operation by now. And I think that's thanks to the time we have spent, and I and my team have spent, building relationships within the business, respecting each of the areas that they work in and the role that they have in the process in getting us back. So at O2, we were kind of famous for our social media handling of a two-day network outage. And that went back as far back as 2012. And the lessons we learned from them are still relevant today. I would sum it up as we're honest, we're fast, we're helpful, and we try and restore issues swiftly. I'm really proud of my press office team. They're highly sophisticated. They have great relationships with press, so that when this time comes, we can update them in a swift and kind of constructive way. But I think for me, the key thing I would say to people is it's really important, certainly as a comms person, that you don't panic. And I think a big part of mitigating any lasting impact is to communicate so positively in the good times, so that you are ready for the bad times when they come. And that's what we're good at. So keep going, stay calm, make sure you've got your voice and your voice is heard. But I have found during crisis, it is a time where comms people are lent upon more than ever in order to help get the business back up and running. And I think that demonstrates the value that we can bring to any organization. So I think it's really important, but please do stay calm, because sometimes it's hard when you're seeing an influx of journalist complaints, customer complaints, tweets coming on through X or Twitter, as it was then in the time. It's really important that you stay calm and just see the wood through the trees and stick to your plan and communicate regularly. Yeah. And one of the things we did in 2012, we communicated right through the night. We gave every hour updates throughout the night of that crisis, and that made a massive difference for us as well. So it was good.
I love a good crisis as well, because a crisis is really when people see good communications professionals at their best. And we've got one of those jobs where almost everyone thinks they can do our job, because they go, well, communication, I can communicate. So really, what is it that you're really doing? You know, because everyone can communicate, everyone can speak English, everyone can write a sentence. And so they all think they can kind of do your job a little bit until a crisis comes along and they go, oh my God, what am I meant to do in this situation? I've got the Times on the line and I've got the Guardian and all these other people. And it's really fascinating how many businesses do not plan for a crisis at all. I've been working with businesses from FTSE 100, Fortune 500. The vast majority of businesses have no crisis plan whatsoever unless they've already had a crisis. And it's kind of crazy, because it's so easy to do. If you think, what are the crisis scenarios? They can be broken down fairly easy. It's kind of, and for anyone listening who is thinking, Christ, I don't have a crisis plan at all, write down on a piece of paper, what are all the worst scenarios that could happen? They are failures of your product. They are members of your staff doing the wrong thing. Going to court. They are customers going to the media with, think of all the things that could go wrong with your product, could go wrong with your people. Write all those things down and work back from there. That's simply how you need to do it. And you should be thinking, what is our answer to each of these questions? And going to the leadership team and saying, what would our answer be in this scenario? And writing those down. That's a really simple way of doing it, just for starters. But if you haven't done that yet, that's a thing to do if you're a comms professional.
Yeah, and get hold of the risk register as well. Most organisations should have a risk register. That is also a very, very good place to start in understanding what other people have put on the risk register that sometimes you may not be aware of. Yeah. So it definitely is worth looking at.
Yeah, and the one bit of advice I'd give, if you're not a comms professional and you're listening to this, you might be a CEO, is when the crisis comes, do not go to the lawyers first. Go to the comms professionals first. In almost every scenario where a crisis has gone badly in comms terms, it's because the organisation has gone to the lawyers and put out a really lawyerly response. And the lawyers have said, don't say anything.
But actually, don't say sorry.
Don't say sorry.
Because then you're sorry. Responsible.
Exactly. And that's exactly the wrong thing to do. You should be apologising early. Apologise for what you haven't done. So go to the comms people first. That will protect your brand and reputation far more than going to the lawyers. Sorry, lawyers, if you're listening. What's one of the biggest comms wins that you've had over the years?
Oh, biggest comms win. I mean, I think the managing of the merger between O2 and Virgin Media O2 has to be up there. So the odds were stacked against us, mainly because it all happened during the pandemic. So we were the first challenger to the big industry incumbent and had two very big established organisations that we had to bring together, integrate quickly, make the press clear about the value of bringing those two organisations together. And for me, it was all about creating a very, very powerful central narrative, which could be articulated, which I suppose articulated our ambition to supercharge the UK. And we got out of the blocks very, very quickly. We were the first to offer an integrated product rolled out within the first couple of months. And it did go down as overwhelmingly positive, both internally and externally. And doing it, don't underestimate how doing that during a pandemic where a lot of the communications were done via Zoom, you can actually sit in a room and nail things and do a big board of what we were going to do. We had to communicate and bring together two comms teams in order to get that kind of aligned narrative and make sure we were clear about what we were saying. And I have to say, I think it was one of the most stressful but most rewarding kind of pieces of activity I've had to do within my career. And I think it will continue to be for a long, long period. I think it's just because of the magnitude of how big I needed to go and what we needed to talk about, rather than just launching a really great product or service. Or, you know, you may have seen some of our DAISY AI activity that we did around fraud at the end of last year. Really great campaigns, but I still believe that actually creating this organization that I work in today was one of the biggest things that I've ever had to do. And I think it was, took some real kind of resilience and really kind of understanding, because with that comes emotion, because organization people are quite set in their ways of I work for O2 or I work for Virgin Media, and also the press and external stakeholders too. And we're having to kind of really kind of make sure you're emotionally tuned in to how others were feeling so that we could get across what we needed to do in the correct way.
Great. And on the other side of the coin, what's been one of your biggest challenges or actually failures where things haven't landed the way you wanted?
I mean, look, I've had many PR disasters that I could tell you about, including kind of exploding tablets, killing someone's dog when we sent chocolate through the post to them. So there's,
really?
There's yes, not things that I'm necessarily proud of.
Oh, my God, you killed someone's dog.
Yeah, I mean, it's not good. It wasn't good. And yeah. Having to deal with that has been, look, quite... it's just, look, it's been interesting. And it goes back to what you said about your lawyers. We have to make sure that we lead communications with empathy. And I think saying sorry and accepting that we've got things wrong is the most important thing. And I think we have to keep that at the heart of it. And a lot of it can be, you know, in organizations, they can be quite, this is what we're doing. We did this for a reason. You have to bring the emotional intelligence, I think, to your communications if you really want to have an impact and put some of the disasters or wrongs right. Because I do think, yeah, it is very important that we do that.
Did that story make it into the media?
Yes, it did. It did make it into the media by our friends at the Daily Mail.
Very good. So what was the headline? O2 kills...
Yeah, kill. I can't remember. Pet dead, I think, is due to O2. Yeah.
And it was were they thank you chocolates or what was the.
They were. They were giving them as a gift to say thank you for their loyalty and also to raise awareness of priority.
Right.
Not what we had intended to do.
And so, what did you do as a, you know, obviously you apologize profusely. What was your kind of comment? Did you buy them another dog or what was
we offered to yes, I don't know if you can ever buy someone's pet,
no,
which is very loyal to them. But we did offer, and I think they did actually take it up on us where they did get a new dog, but it was very upsetting for them as individuals and also for us having to deal with it because nobody could have anticipated that. And it's those kind of situations where you really need to think and make sure you think of it from the other person's perspective about how it's come across and what they're going through.
Well, that's certainly a hard one. And we often send chocolates to our clients all the time. And I didn't even think twice that that I should not send chocolates in case, you know, a dog accidentally eats them. But I wonder if your policy's changed now on
yeah, we don't send it.
Don't send it. The poor chocolate companies.
Yeah, exactly.
What message would you give to your younger self?
Oh, I think trust your instincts. I think if you're in the comms business, you've usually got a pretty good instinct And I spent a long time questioning whether that instinct was right or wrong. But I think trust it is really important. I think this is a classic one for me, is worry less, because I think sometimes I spend my life overthinking. And I have a good debate with my lawyer at the moment where he's like, you're always thinking of the worst case scenario, Nicola. And I'm always thinking about the most positive scenario. And I think, look, that's good, but you've just got to make sure that you kind of keep it intact and don't overthink and over worry about things. Because I suppose that my third thing is, I do believe that everything reveals itself in time and at the right time. So you've just got to believe in yourself and keep going. But I think they're my things that I would, messages that I would probably give to my younger self.
And is there a favourite form of media that you have?
We have just moved to new offices in Paddington, so I have a bit of a longer commute than I was used to. I am spending a lot of time on podcasts at the moment, which is obviously good in light of this. But I find them quite useful. I find them quite informative and getting different opinions on very, very different things. So, and not all work related, some of them about health and biohacking I'm really into at the moment. So
any that you'd recommend?
I would. And I would really recommend Rochelle Humes's new one, which is Ladies Who Launch. Where she kind of talks to entrepreneurs who've really kind of set up their own business and talk about the challenges that she faced. I listened to that a couple of days ago and just think, she's an amazing person, of how she's gone from a pop star right the way through to a businesswoman who has got very successful brands under her watch at the moment. But I do find it very, very interesting thinking about what some other CEOs in smaller organizations are going through and how they're pulling their teams together, how they're dealing with it. And I think that provides really good insight that I think you can bring the outside in into corporate organizations just by listening to some of that and understanding some of that. So yeah, I would definitely recommend, she's only had one out at the moment, but I have high hopes for Ladies Who Launch and other kind of guests that she brings in and information that they have.
Right. And you've got a very busy life, and we're recording this podcast just a few minutes late because you've just come straight from presenting something else to your board. What do you do to unwind?
Oh, what do I do? So I do Pilates and find that very, very good at just taking time out. I spend a lot of time, and I'm not sure whether it is relaxing, ferrying my kids to hockey and football matches, which I actually do find relaxing, because I do think it's completely different to what I do on a day to day. And also I enjoy spending time with my children. But I also have a good group of friends. I'm quite active in my local community and that helps me unwind. But Pilates is my big thing that I try and do twice a week in order just to take my brain away from the comings and goings of everyday life that we're faced with. So yeah, they're my key things.
Great. And final question, if you could have dinner with anyone alive or dead, who would it be?
I think it would be Michelle Obama. Well, I would always say Michelle Obama. And then when I was thinking about this, I actually thought, maybe I should go and see Trump's missus and see what she really thinks about what's going on and
that
how she deals with Trump in a daily kind of basis and what she really thinks about what is going on. Now, whether she would tell us, I don't know. But Milana, maybe.
It'd be good if you could have a couple of glasses of wine with her and she'd really let loose. I mean, I do wonder how much time that she even spend together, don't you?
Me too, which is why she probably will say, yeah, it's all great, it's fine, because she's never there. She's obviously pleased that he's got Elon Musk as a babysitter now. She's probably thought, I'll leave him to it and move away. But yeah, who knows? We'll never know what really goes on. But it'll be fascinating to actually get a glimpse of that and to understand it a little bit. But
well, let's see how long that lasts. And I'm sure Elon Musk needs his own babysitter. Nicola Green, Chief Communications and Corporate Affairs Officer at Virgin Media O2. You've been speaking to me, John Higginson, on Communicating Purpose.